Welcome to the podcast. We're talking cybersecurity. If you don't know, Imperial Security Bureau, the name comes from Star Wars. It's the CIA in Star Wars. Today we've got Lance James. He's the CEO of Unit 221B. It's a cybersecurity consulting firm. They do a lot. They're actually like the Navy SEALs of cybersecurity hackers. You call them in whenever you need to find the real deal, you know, dirty SOBs, right? They're disruptors, hackers, hunters, scientists. You can read about his story on the website, and here's a lot of services that they offer. Get with him if you need some help. But let's check out his LinkedIn. So here he is, Unit 221B. He's going to tell you where he came up with that name and what that's all about. It's an interesting story. He's an interesting guy overall. This wasn't even a cybersecurity podcast, honestly. This was like a mental health, and I don't even know how to explain it. We covered a lot of ground and interesting to chat with. He's actually hiring right now. I might be able to help him with that. He talks at cybersecurity conferences. I mean, if we walk through some of the things he's done, he's been a founder, CEO, threat analyst, director of intelligence, chief scientist, head of cyber intelligence for Deloitte, advisory board member, chief scientist, CISO at Flashpoint, chief scientist, VP of engineering. Now he runs his own company. If you go on YouTube, hang on, he's all over the place here. I mean, he's got a bunch of interviews from 7 years ago up to 7 months ago. So we're going to add to this list here. I like how he shows up next to Joe Rogan and Edward Snowden, and Bob Lazar. Anyway, yeah, I'm excited to chat with him, and I hope you enjoy. So here we go. Welcome to the podcast, Lance James. I'm excited to talk to you. How are you, man?
I am great. Busy, but I'm great.
Yeah, busy morning, busy afternoon already. So couple warm-up questions for you here. I normally ask like your favorite Star Wars movie. It's getting a little stale. I mean, as you can tell, I'm a Star Wars fan, but what's your favorite movie overall?
Actually, Star Wars is on the list.
Okay, good.
And it, for me, I think it's Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
It was the one choice. Time George Lucas did not direct on the... in the first trilogy. Overall favorite movie is The Princess Bride. Down to the point, okay. My daughter's middle name is Buttercup, named after it. So,
yeah. Wow. You know, I still haven't seen that. Elon Musk even mentions that movie. Yeah, I have never seen it. It threw me off. It's not a sci-fi movie. What is it?
No, it's a cliche. It's not sci-fi. Think of it as almost like funny, but it's a cliche on all of the fairy tale type movies. It's got fencing and sword fighting and like war strategy and set in like, I don't know, some off land where there's princesses and prince and all this other stuff and then pirates and stuff. But it's kind of like a cliche in all of the adventure movies out there.
Okay.
And I have the book on my shelf as well. And the reason it was named The Princess Bride is because the daughter was like five at the time. And he's like, "Where should I come on?" He's like, "Princesses and a bride." Like, you know, so it ended up being like, so it's like just an offshoot comedy / fun adventure. I have like movies down to like sections, like comedy, Blazing Saddles. You know what I mean? Sci-fi is definitely I love TNG, like the Star Trek TNG, but I love Star Wars is like kind of like my favorite sci-fi. I used to watch the first episode a million times when I was a kid, like episode 4.
Yeah, nice. So, good deal. I know you're a musician. What's your favorite band or musician yourself?
Boyz II Men. So, I love the 90s R&B. So I'm a musician that grew up around, like, I was a classically trained violin and piano. I started going to, like, when I was in North Carolina, I started going to, like, black churches and stuff because of where I was living and situations and such in the 90s. And I always chose a church by its music. And so, you know, grew up Anglican, you know, Episcopalian, you know, pretty much like the Christian light or whatever it is. But essentially, like, the organ itself was like, if it was a bigger organ, I would go there because the piano teacher, my piano teacher, and my dad was a Marine, so we traveled a lot. So the organist usually would end up being my piano teacher because they're usually the best in the town. But then I started going to like an AME's, you know, gospel church, and I'm like, oh my God, the music is here is literally amazing. I started hanging out with that, and then I started listening to like Boyz II Men and Harmonies. And, you know, I also, second favorite is like Bobby McFerrin, who's like more of a jazz, like, slash, he's known for Don't Worry, Be Happy, but that's not his, like, you know, everybody's got a pop song. Stevie Wonder says, right. I just called it to say I love you, but there's a ton of greater songs. So, yeah.
Good deal. So, yeah, I was not expecting that. Used to listen to that stuff. I get down.
I love their harmonies. Like, actually, my favorite songs are actually the ones where they do like Yesterday and It's So Hard to Get, you know, where they take the harmony.
I'm hearing right now.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Did I hear you say something about North Carolina? You used to
I lived in North Carolina. So I started when I was a teenager. My dad was, I lived in New Bern. And so I started doing music there. And that's when I started checking out some of the different churches around. So it's cool. Yeah.
All right, cool.
Are you in North Carolina? Or?
I am. Yeah, I'm in Raleigh.
You're in Raleigh, Durham, aren't you? Yeah. So when you said something about B-sides, I was like, actually, I'd love to go because also my friend lives in Charlotte, my best friend. So I'm like, I haven't been to NC in a while. So
Kill two birds with one stone there. We'll have to get you out. They're not for sale yet, but maybe we can get you on as a speaker there. It'd be my first time going. I can't claim to be involved yet, but hey, I did just go to a cybersecurity conference on. It was last Friday. It was in Raleigh. It's called Kakalaki Con, and we had a great time.
Right? That sounds like so Southern, Kakalaki Con.
Oh yeah, I had to go. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff going on. You know, lock picking and the conference room is, you know, guest speakers. And there's a place where you have to solder your own board, like for your badge. It was really unique. There was also this table full of stickers, right? I was flipping through hundreds of stickers here. And this one caught my attention. It's right here. It's this little bot, right?
Yeah.
And on the badge, it says Blue Team AF. can you explain this to me? What's the story on that?
So Blue Team, in general, you heard of Red Team and Blue Team.
Yeah,
so
Red Team,
a lot
Blue
of people
Team.
In the security industry love the stunt work, right? You know, hacking in and the joy of that. It produces dopamine and we're like, oh, I broke in. And it's like this adrenaline rush and such like that. So on the Red Team side, and then there's a Blue Team. There's also, it's called a Purple Team. But on the Blue Team and the Red Team, you have this adrenaline Red Team. We're hacking in, like all the hackers. It seems exciting. It's what most gets most people in the industry. Is like, ooh, I want to like hack stuff, right?
Hackers.
I'll tell you what though, as a red teamer myself, I have mad respect for blue teamers because that's the discipline team, right? We have to like defend against one line of code that might be found against like some attacker that's agile, and our entire environment and organization has to like be able to log, monitor, detect, respond, all of these things, contain if they get in or this or that. And it requires massive organizational skills, massive understanding of policies, massive understanding of monitoring, massive understanding of a totally different discipline and tradecraft. It is very, you know, the people who get fired are the ones, got breached because some, you know, person on the other side. And the hard job is the blue team. So I massively respect when someone's like, blue team is F, because, you know, it's a hardcore job. I don't think I would, I've been a CISO before. And I'm telling you, the trick was my director was who made me look good. That person, I was like mad respect to. I was like being a leader, but like that dude was pragmatic, organized, like had a system in place, had a plan in place. I was great for the quick decisions here and there. Right. But I'm telling you, that is like a certain mindset not everybody would be good at. And I have a mad respect for it because it is the absolute opposite of my abilities. And so I think Blue Team AF is key. You know what I mean? So, like,
okay. That makes sense. So Blue Team, more methodical, more organized, more buttoned up, you know?
Yeah. And they're defending. Their job is to protect against somebody like me. That's going to go in and try to break in and find that one. Cause they have a hard job because it's like 1000 lines of like, you know, one mistake and then the hacker's in.
Yeah.
And so
they
have to guard the entire castle. Right, against a very agile ninja.
Yeah, so, and that's it. Seems impossible. By the way, listen to some of the folks talk at Kakalaki Con. I'm going into the weeds about how you get hacked and faking websites. And
the key to Blue Team though is that to know that they're gonna get in. It's that can you pick that up and contain them when they
quickly.
Are, so they don't become the risk or impact to your organization. Where I was asked CISO at, we were an intelligence firm, so we did counterintelligence against like we. We had an entire team of analysts that were designed to talk to bad guys, like the most like awful people, right? That were going to try to hack you. And we had to problem solve how to like guard that while they're doing that. How do we protect the user? And that's why I said it's truly a tradecraft and art form, mad respect. And they didn't knock on wood today, but they didn't get any breaches in that sense. Like we had like incidents. They were trying to attack the organization. Then we went into IR mode and it was amazing. Cause I'm like block all Tor and VPN accesses into our thing is that they're trying to hit us And the dude got lazy and we got an IP address and we're able to send FBI to the house. We were debating on pizza versus FBI. We were thinking FBI with pizza, right? You know, and the dude was living at his mom's house, ironically down the street from me. His dad died 5 years ago. Usually sometimes these people do this because there's like mental health problems, right? Actually many. If you're not government, it's usually mental health problems. So like, you know, like, so it was funny because we see all these logs going like him trying to hit stuff. And they just stopped because then I get a text and the FBI showed up like, okay, stopped.
Yeah. Over now. Because
it is
clear.
But I want to give props. It is doable. It's like a bulletproof vest. And like if you have the mentality of saying that someone can't fire their gun at us and not cause injury because I've got a bulletproof vest, even if they hit my chest, injury will still occur. If you've ever gotten hit with a bulletproof vest, it feels like a hammer against your chest. It's not that it's not going to hurt. It's just not going to kill you or cause major risk or impact. So it allows you or your backup to be in a, you know, still in a firefight, right? It's the same here, is that it's going to cause impact. It will hit you. You're hoping that hit is the warning sign to like take action and do stuff. The big adversary obviously is the government. And that's why it's like really difficult, because those ones are targeted and you know, those guys, they get all the money in the world to get into your networks.
Well, so I watched your interview on Riddler Lab and it was like a year ago, but I heard
about that,
kind of how you got into cyber first through music and that got you interested in cryptography, right?
Yeah. So I practiced, played violin and piano as a child. I was a very disciplined child. My household was from the 80s and my dad was a Marine. So pop the light at 5 a.m., get your ass out of bed, boy. Kind of 80s, you know, style. Get up, practice 2 hours a day, go to school, come home, practice more. Sometimes I'd be at a music school. So then that's also practice during school, right?
Oh, wow.
But my parents, you know, middle class, but heavily invested in my music because I had a knack for it, like a really good knack for it, right? I ended up surpassing, when we were in Yuma, Arizona, by 8, I surpassed my music teachers, all the teachers there. So we had to travel 3 hours up to Phoenix and 3 hours down every Saturday for music lessons. And, you know, they all said I had these potentials. So there was the teachers invested in me. So my parents invested in
stuff,
right? I was at a music camp when I was like 8 years old. And I saw this, like, you know, it was like back in the 80s, you know, parents want to go and do a summer vacation. So you get dropped out of a music camp and you stay with a family. And so I stayed with this family, the Davidsons or whatever. And they had this Apple IIe, you know, gray, non-color looking, like the green one. Back then, they required programming to even use, but they had games and all this stuff. And it's funny because, like, you know, my parents would call the family and check in with me like every 2 weeks or so or whatever. They're like, and the Davidson lady, she was like, I thought you said he practiced. He's been on the computer the entire time. So like I started like getting this divide between like, ooh, this is cool, right? And then my parents also around 8 also got an Apple IIe for business reasons. My mom was in real estate or something like that. And they got the nice one, the big one, right?
Right.
I think it was like a business expense. So I think it was just like that. But I actually still have that computer, which is my first official computer. I started writing code for it that like, my, you know, to have games on it. And I'm not going to ask, but I don't know where they get all the pirated games, because it was like, even back then, there was like discs just with like names of games on them and shit. Like it wasn't bot games, right? I'm like, piracy has been going on forever, right? So,
right.
So it was funny because I'm like, you know, because I think it was handed to us through a business thing and it was like, all right, cool. And so like I ended up learning how to code for it because like the user manual was like using Apple Basic. And essentially I was like always playing detective and spy as a kid. So I had a wild imagination and stuff. And I like spy books and Sherlock Holmes books and all this stuff. So I decided to password protect my games in the code. So I modified the game Run Hello program to then have a pass like into your name. So if my parents, if it wasn't my name, it would just go to their game so that it was like, you know, like they didn't get upset with me or whatever. But then if it had my name, it was like, welcome to X-Men Security Systems, enter your password. And then I actually had it where the joystick was this like boxy looking thing that like went like this and this. So I was learning about X and Y plotting. And so I actually wrote it as a combination lock. So I used the joystick to make it as a combination lock to unlock the game. Like, so it would like then go, here's your list of secret games. And I would like, you know, and I just changed text in it and saying, welcome to the CIA, blah, 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 you know, just like imaginary stuff. And it's like, here's your list of, you know, missions, da, 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 right? You know, so I still have that program to this day. I had to go into the code to remember what the password was that I put for it. So I got into
to look at.
I got into computers a little bit, right? And like, I really liked them. But I still, you know, I had to practice and this and that. And then also I liked codes and ciphers as a kid, right? Because of the whole spy game and all this stuff. And when I was a kid, I would like, you know, send, like we take the pencil and roll to the Caesar cipher where you'd write a letter on like a strip of paper and then roll it around and like do this and then that. I liked the Vignette. I liked the diff and math. So like I actually liked cryptography and like codes and ciphers. So as I got older as a musician too, it's just like kind of matched the patterns. Like when you learn how to be a trained musician, there's studies on this that say that like pattern matching, left and right brain, blah, blah, blah. They've even done like temporal analysis that it tends to produce highly more successful people when it comes to stuff like this, because especially when you have a discipline at a young age, because then you learn how to be disciplined later. And it's not like an adjustment, right? You know, so in that process, though, I liked patterns and stuff. And so I liked coding. I liked like cryptography. And then I created I2P when I was like 18 or 19. I was actually coming from a dream. I was at 4 in the morning. And I2P is a peer-to-peer anonymous like sharing system so that it was like you could have freedom of speech. It was in like the early 2000s when 9/11 came around and people were worried about stuff online and freedom. And I stayed away from the file sharing wars. I just was focused on the speech. So I just focused on chat and things like that. But it was really about learning how to do cryptography. And so I tend to apply. I'll jump in a project and go, all right, how do I do this? And I'll be reading papers. And then I'm like, it's time for me to like take this knowledge and figure this out. And then I even used my musical side one time for one of my first major gigs. This is declassified now, but this was like for a three-letter agency when I first started my first company.
Oh, wow.
And it was that because I have perfect pitch, right? So which means that if you hum a note, I can tell you what it is, right? So one day I was like typing, on my keyboard, and I was listening to a friend over the phone and said, did you just press the enter key? Did you press the space key? And then I didn't know all the other keys there, but I knew that it's like a drum. And so you could actually do like, recording. If you recorded the keyboard and you could hear the typings, the upspring, not the downspring, the upspring stays the same. And you could at least figure out zones, QWER, ASDF, ZXY, V, things like that.
Oh, okay, wow.
That's right top, that's middle top, middle right left, that's this and that. And then you do frequency analysis if you get enough sampling of writing, and you could actually acoustically hear what people were typing.
Wow. Right?
Back then, before data science the way it is today, it took like 15-minute samples. I offered this idea because I wrote the code and prototype to a three-letter agency, and they're like, yes, please. So it's how I busted, bumped it through and got my first business going, because it was a contract for it. Where, imagine surveillance and such like that with a laser microphone, right?
Wow.
Warrant, so yeah, it's cool.
That is cool. So, yeah, I also read on your website you hacked a radio to become its own radio station, right?
Yeah. What?
Were you playing your own music, or were you playing?
Yeah, I was playing NWA, actually. I was playing NWA because, like, okay. I was like in a rebellion. I was thinking of a seventh grade, right? I wasn't allowed to listen to that kind of stuff, rightfully so. I get that. You get the mixtapes, you get the recorded tapes, you trade tapes at school, right? And so I liked NWA, the rap, Compton music, Ice Cube, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it was also, it was racy, like on the airwaves. And there was this movie called Pump Up the Volume that had Christian Slater in it. And I was living in Arizona as well. And I was like, he made this pirate radio station and he would play just like the craziest stuff and be crude on the radio. Well, I'm a seventh grader. I'm not like some high school kid, but I was like, So I was playing around with toy walkie-talkies, right? And I would pull apart the crystals. The crystals in toy walkie-talkies, at least in the 80s, were 49.8, 60 megahertz, right? CB radios were 27, and some remote radios were also, 27 or 49, right? And I had a bunch of books on from the 70s, like on electronics and radio frequencies. And I had read about what's called harmonic frequencies. Harmonic frequencies is essentially a weaker signal, but if you double it, so 49.860 times 2 is 99.7 FM. So what I did is, since I was into CB radios, I had a wattage booster already. So I then basically took apart the toy walkie-talkie and hooked it into the wattage booster the same way we do a CB radio. I just taped down the button. Right. I taped it down with scotch tape, not scotch tape, but electric tape to hold down a microphone, hung it on my laundry thing outside, dry your laundry outside, set up some chairs, had like an antenna, like used a lot of steel and antenna and a barbecue grill. And it went about 20 miles on this open area of 99.7. And I would just I'd do it for an hour a night before my parents got home. And just play a bunch of NWA and like turn on the radio inside and like listen to the fact that it would do this. You know what I mean? I was more into the hack, not the,
right,
the piracy part. You know what I mean? I don't care.
That's hilarious.
I just was like, oh, this is cool. So, and it went 40 miles if you had a walkie talkie, because remember, it's a lesser week. So it probably upset all the kids in the neighborhood, because they're just like, what? Because they couldn't talk.
Yeah. Change the channel.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Me and my brother, we bought these ham radios after we saw that movie, Leave the World Behind. on. We were like, oh man, this is happening.
Yes.
So we got these radios, started figuring out how to use towers, like the repeater towers. And it's harder than you think to like get into that stuff. There's like a whole world.
It's
crazy.
I kind of got out of it and over it, but like when I was a kid, that like CB radios was the thing to do, right? And then radio stuff and stuff, because it was kind of like
it might come back.
It was like the internet, because it was the way to travel through communication. And I think obviously we all love the idea that we can speak to someone 1,000 miles away from us, you know what I mean?
Right.
So
if you're into frequencies, you might appreciate, I don't know if you listen to Joe Rogan, but he just had on Terrence Howard. And wild, dude.
I've seen some of his stuff, and I need to fact check Terrence Howard. I don't know if he's got some actual like some of the stuff, you know, like it's
out there.
Yeah, it's out there. Like, I think we can all admit that. So I saw some stuff on Instagram, right? And again, like, just because they're an actor doesn't make them legit in science, right?
But
doesn't mean that there isn't some truth to it. I can't speak to it because I don't know how far that truth is and stuff. Because it does feel outlier, but I'm like, well, there could be some truths, like, you know, in meditation and things, you know, a lot of people say that like there are theories and stuff, and even in neuroscience about like sound frequencies affecting the brain. My wife is actually a PhD student in neuroscience. She works on something totally different, but she deals with frequencies and signals with EEGs and fMRIs, right? But I saw something on it and I like saved it to be like, all right, I want to fact check and see what he's talking about. Cause it's like, also I saw it out of context.
Send me your findings. Cause I was sharing it with all kinds of people. Cause I mean, he's basically redid the periodic table, and it's not just him. He's like referencing some scientists that were from a while back. I can't remember their name now, but it's interesting, man. Like, I would love to hear your thoughts about it. It was blowing my mind. I saved it too. I'm going to watch it again.
Yeah.
But stuff like that is wild.
Well, actually, you know, what's kind of funny is you might like this. When you have time, go to spinscore.io. This is a always free thing.
Okay.
I wrote it, and it uses AI to check bias, fallacies, and misleading information inside of articles and YouTube videos. So if he's like, you can take the Joe Rogan YouTube video, right, of Terrence Howard, you can throw the link in there and it will analyze the, like, you know, every statement and everything like this, and it'll tell you why. It's like a professor. So it's more, it's not just, oh, it's got bias, right? It's this section has bias, this statement has bias, this is a suggestion to change bias. So in the YouTube videos, you can hit the, like, you know, get a speaker breakdown of bias or this or that. And it's good because then at least it'll give you a starting point to like, okay, I'll go look into this and see if I can get more information on this. Because sometimes it's just not citing information. And I'll tell you, I did a TED talk once, a TEDx talk. I ran it through and I got an F, which makes absolute sense because a TEDx talk is 11 minutes, no citing material, and mostly about like an enthusiastic way to deliver a message about something you truly believe in.
Oh yeah,
so rightfully so, gave me an F, right? I was like, oh, that's actually not surprising, and everything it said is absolutely correct. So I'm not actually upset with it. It's a good like process, and I actually have a writing mode where I check my writing before I post things to make sure it's like a little bit more even keel. And it'll, if you have like news articles, you can also generate a neutral version of it that removes bias but keeps the article. It's really cool. So.
Wow. Okay. I'll check that out. I need to point all my podcasts towards it and see what it says.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you. So if you have your podcast on YouTube, right, you can literally give it a link and it'll analyze it and it'll take about 30 seconds and it'll give you a fun fact while you're waiting. And I'm always going to keep it free. It's just a project I had in my head during Christmas when I got bored and I was like, you know what? Election season's coming up. Lots of stuff going on worldwide. People are always asking about like, how's the news? And I wanted a way to be able to read the news without getting emotionally excited. So generating neutral news, I'm like, all right, this is how I read my news now. You know what I mean? So I still get the news, but it's not like, because, you know, whether it's Trump or Biden or any of these things, what I'll do is there'll be reporters that like obviously don't like Trump or obviously don't like Biden.
Every time.
I want to remove that and just hear the news. Do you know what I mean? That's my voting decision, not yours. You know what I mean? So,
I'm with you there. Yeah, they put spin on everything.
And it affects us. It affects us. It does. It absolutely does. Yeah.
Do you follow a guy, Daniel Meisler? He's got a tool. It's something he created called Fabric, and it's measures the value density in content, and it'll score it from 1 to 10 based on how much value it's delivering for the amount of time you're watching it. So before he listens to anything, He wants to know what the density of value is. And if it scores low, he doesn't waste his time with it.
How do I find the fabric thing?
So he has a YouTube channel called Unsupervised Learning.
Okay, I'll take a look. Yeah, send me a link on LinkedIn later. And then,
I will.
Because yeah, I don't want to get distracted like rabbit holing while I'm with you.
Right, yeah. We're really good at rabbit holing on this podcast. I want to give you a chance to talk about your company. You know, you're an entrepreneur and the name of the company is catchy. I know it's like a reference to a Sherlock Holmes, but where'd it come from and what do you guys do?
It's a funny kind of story. Right. So I was at Deloitte for a while because my other company was like kind of like I got swallowed up by Deloitte. And I was there for 2 years. I had to be there for 2 years. Part of the golden handcuffs rule. Right. You know, and honestly, I loved the experience because big business is like a whole different genre of thing to learn. Navigating politics and this stuff, you know. And then I was, you know, over at Flashpoint, you know, which I loved. That experience was different. Right. It was building from startup, like 15 people. I was one of the 15 to holy crap, now they're doing really, really, really well. And I think they got acquired and then reacquired. And I think they're acquiring companies. I had to leave there just because TMI, but my son passed and I could do about a year left before I needed to really get some, I needed a break. Sure. It wasn't about Flashpoint or anything like that. And so I just, you know, kind of did my recovery, you know.
Yeah.
And then I was looking at, and Unit 221B was kind of there before, but it wasn't really like there, right? And my friend, who I used to work with in the national security days back in the early 2000s, remember I was telling you I make some fun things. My first company was a national security focused company, right? We call it threat intelligence today, but back then it was called cyber counterintelligence. And most of it was either for my company, it was banks or three letter agencies, right?
Got it.
And so, you know, I played in the spooky world and he's from the UK, right? And he was part of MI6 for years or whatever. And between our country and his country, we'd work on ally type work and I would help them, you know, spy hunt. Essentially. Years later, like, and I don't know if you've seen the BBC Sherlock, but you know, when you, there's a kind of a mix where this brother is a bit of a spy, works for the, you know, Mycroft is a bit of a, you know, intelligence guy, and he's more of a consulting person, but he's like mixed in the middle. I've always been that kind of same person where I was mixed in the middle, or I wasn't like never really officially a spy, but I was always helping with the hunting and consulting right. to these spy agencies, right?
You're like gray Jedi, right? Gray Jedi. Yeah, you're not on the dark side. No, you're not on the light side. You're in the gray.
I was in the gray. And that's an area that intelligence needs because they want to, you know, have things unofficial. Right. So I was always playing the unofficial things. Right. Yeah. And so and that my first company was big on unofficial things. Right. So but we were good at attribution. We kind of mastered that really good. Finding people and also hacking hackers. Like I was always good at breaking the payloads or the bad things that they had and able to use it to like track them down and stuff like that. Right. So years later, I'm at RSA with my bud, a guy from the UK. And I was like, I need to come up with a cool name for this company. And he goes, whatever you do, make it subtle, but Sherlock Holmes, because that's what you are. You're a cyber consulting detective. And I'm like, you know, a couple of hours later and we're all hanging out and stuff. I'm like, I think I got it. Unit is in a group of people. Also sounds military-ish. 221B is in 221B Baker Street. I said, .com. I said, one, Mandiant will probably block it for a year because it looks like a Chinese domain. And two, it's subtle, but it's like really cool. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that's how the name came around, right?
It piqued my interest when I
right.
found it.
And to people who don't get it, think it's in like a cool elite, like ex-CIA outfit, right?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Right. And so, and then they get it. And some people are like, oh, I think I like the other one. And like, and then some people who are Sherlock, they get it. And they're like, oh my gosh. Right.
Right.
And so then the company was formed because like, when I go through like the Deloitte's and the Flashpoints, all the people that I had at Deloitte and even before, I'm a leader that people like, we end up like coming in as a crew. Right. I feel like I'm kind of like the umbrella holder to some amazing people in my world. Right. I'm very technical, but they are, you know, all the subsets of geniuses with heart, like, you know, really good people. They're like family over the years of 20 years, right? I've been very lucky to be able to, like, one of my, and I say this, like, this is something that was told to me, so I'm just going to say it more just factually. It's not about bragging. But one of my abilities is to be able to find the potential in talent, like people. Like, and I could see that from a mile away when I meet someone. I get this, like, weird feeling of spark, and I'm like, you're coming with me. Yeah. I got an idea, right? Mm-hmm. And I did that with, like, I don't know if you know who Alison Nixon is, but she was in 60 Minutes a few weeks ago. She was in Wired magazine in front page for like December and January.
Is she a researcher?
She's a security researcher. She tracks bad guys and stuff, right?
I did. I tried to invite her.
Yeah, so she's just super busy. She's in Rwanda right now. So like she's just like that. So she works with us, obviously. She's like a sister to me. And I met her through Brian Krebs in 10, 12 years ago or something.
You know Brian?
Yeah, Brian's a really close friend of mine. So like Brian and like we go to like a Black Hat or it's like we're like an entourage. We all hang out together, right? So Brian had met her through because like when he got swatted, she was helping him. And then when he got swatted, I was helping him, but we didn't know each other. So Brian's like, you got to meet your collective persistent threats against these bad guys, right? And so we all like did dinner and I saw her talk and she saw mine. And Brian was on stage with me for my talk at that year. I think it was 2013.
Wow.
So she was working at like some pen test job. Apparently, she tells the story is that I poached her in front of her boss and I didn't realize it. She also thought I was on cocaine because I was very hyper. But then she was like, well, but you never went to the bathroom. So I'm like, no, I'm just hyper. So I was poaching her, blah, blah, blah. But like, you know, fast forward, like she was like one of my first proteges of like, dude, I mean, I've had some before, but like, I was like, I have a spark. Hadn't had that in a while. And I'm like, I just want to get you the runway. Come with me. Like, cause she was tracking bad guys for a hobby. I said, you want to do it with real impact, real handcuffs, real cruise missiles if you're down, you know, that kind of stuff, right? C6 the handcuffs ones. And so, but like, I'm like, I have the world that you need to be in, that connection, nice. Right? And so but she was at it with me at Deloitte. And so it was like Sean and Joel and all these people. And then when I went to Flashpoint, I told Flashpoint, I come as a team, here's the team, right? Yeah. You know, and then Unit 2 to Win, we were all like, why don't we just do it this ourselves? We've seen all the good things about companies and the things that we necessarily are, not saying they're bad, but they're not in our, you know, interests. So why don't we do it the way that's on our interest and do this ourselves? Because we're a bunch of rock stars in our own way. And we have you know, these passions and stuff. And so we wanted to build something that allowed us to like disrupt bad guys, you know, utilize the relationships we already have and do this more in a way where it's not like we're all in different departments. Right. You know, because like Allison would be in one department of Flashpoint. I'd be running engineering and she'd be there. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah.
I wouldn't give her the coverage she needed sometimes. You know what I mean? So I'm like, why don't we go back to like doing this all together? You know, so we ended up doing a business together. And so Unit 221B is literally a collective of the most amazing people I've ever met together in one room trying to run a company.
It's like the Navy SEALs of cyber.
Yeah.
Security,
the FBI used to call us under, you know, unofficially the Cyber SEAL Team 6. So
Yeah. So, yeah, nailed it. Well, that's awesome, man. Yeah, yeah. I have to follow you. I'm excited to, I feel lucky to even have you on here, man. This is crazy. So I watched your B-Sides keynote, the one from B-Sides NYC about ransomware. I watched the TEDx youth talk you did about protecting the brain. I mean, you're an extremely confident, outgoing guy. And I saw your video on LinkedIn. You're singing in the bathroom, right? You're fearless, like, and you're not afraid of putting yourself out there. Which is wild because most people in leadership in cybersecurity are they stay behind the scenes, right? And especially CISOs. And how did you become, you know, so confident and fearless and able to put yourself out there? And do you have an approach or a mindset that you keep whenever you are going to post something or put yourself on a video like this?
Sometimes it's impulsive. Like the bathroom thing was probably impulsive. And sometimes I wonder if I should regret it. You know, I always ask myself, is this a LinkedIn thing? But okay. So I'm going to be absolutely honest with you on this. You have to know where you stand in your rankings. Right. What I mean is unfortunately, and I don't agree with this, but people look at titles and look at like where you're at. And how people perceive me in the security industry is some kind of like the big boy, like a big dude in this, right? Well earned, do not get me wrong, but most of it is theater. What I mean by that is it's PR, getting a TED talk, that's a theater thing. That's a hookup. Like the point was, is that like me being on Mr. Robot was all strategized by a PR and marketing team, right? And like, I was out with Brian Krebs. We were at CES and the Mr. Robot writers were there. I talked myself into it. Right. And they were like, oh, this is a good idea. And, you know, like that kind of stuff. Right. So some of it's opportunity, luck, pushing yourself out there, this and that. But what I'm saying is like people, like, for instance, when I was at B-Sides for New York, I felt uncomfortable because I missed the days of being an absolute beginner at a conference. So they see the keynote and all these young kids are coming up and like, ha, da, da, da. And I have to like, oh, I have to be careful what I say. You know, it's a different climate and I haven't been out in a bit and it's like post COVID and it's new. And like, you gotta get used to that whole, like not being locked up again. Right. And it was challenging for me because I was like overthinking for a little bit, but I'm also just like there's a joke that's been running since like 2006. You give me a stage, even if I was drinking and drunk, I will perform. Right. Like, it's just like this thing. So like speaking wise, I can give advice on that. But some of it's just, I know where I stand. And I also know that when you know where you stand, you know that, like, I believe that since that's how the world sees you, right? Like these levels and stuff, it's best, like, how do you use your platform to like inspire and just be yourself? Because no matter what's going to happen where I stand, I'm going to probably always be myself. That's probably also another reason why I run a company, is because I got to probably do it the way I want to do it. And I'm not going to lie about that. It doesn't mean I'm not afraid sometimes. I'm going to be very clear. But I also learned something about myself. So I got into computer science and I got into all this stuff because I run towards fear. If I am afraid of it, I run towards it to try to understand the best. Some people, you know, they go away from it. Those both are right. Viable options. Fight, flight, right? Freeze is probably not a viable option if there's a tiger. But fight and flight, you know, so I am technically like, let's fight, right? Like AI came out. I'm like, let me understand this as much as I can so that I can guide people out of being not afraid of it, but understanding it. Because what kills fear is the building a bridge of understanding, right? People always ask, and this is going to sound like philosophical, but the reality is underneath what this isn't about business. This isn't about this and that. And isn't it just about perception management? It's that I look at Snoop Dogg. Let's take a look at Snoop Dogg, for instance. That guy gets paid millions of dollars for being absolutely himself. Millions of dollars.
He does.
That you got to respect that. You're just like, he's Grandpa now and all this stuff. But he gets paid for being himself, right? And that's a good lesson. I see the world where it's like, if people don't learn their voice, their boundaries, their this. Like there's something I always try to teach in the culture here is your voice is your number one asset. If you don't use it and you're resentful, that is kind of, as an adult, that's your fault, right? Yeah. Like, I don't mean that, you know, there are caveats there. You know, 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, they're absolutely still learning to use the world. But if you're my age and I'm not using my voice, that's on me that I didn't, you know, get my way, right? And I didn't get where I wanted to go. And if I get all upset about it because I never expressed it, then that's going to make me look, you know, I'm going to just be this mad, upset, dumb-looking, reactive dude. So, like, love, like, a lot of people ask what love is, right? And love, in my definition, is the idea of willing to understand someone, period. Like making that effort and action to constantly understand someone, whether you're married, whether you're in workplace, whether this, it all falls under an idea of respect. You're taking a present moment and present time and place to like do this. So where I look at it is that if I put myself out there, for instance, when I lost my son, if you go into my history, I shared how I felt and the breakthroughs that I had through grieving, because I know I wish none of that to happen to someone, but it will happen to some people in our industry. And it wasn't about like, oh, I'm going through this, feel sorry for me. It was always posted after I went through the layer of lesson that was in that time of that moment. And I learned, okay, this is feeling, right? And what it really is that there's part of love, and this is also just, you're going to give a gift. We're in a community, we're in a security community. And whether it's like, I have music, right? Which like, I don't want to be a famous musician, but I do want to like give it. Like there's no point having a gift of music if you can't give it out there. Yeah. And the same is my knowledge, right? I want to share my knowledge because that's like what all the conferences are really about, is you get excited to share and learn knowledge together. It's a kind of the beautiful part about all these conferences. And so if I'm doing a keynote, I want to be the best at what I do there. And I want to be comfortable and be myself, because the kid in the audience that wants to get there, but in his own way, may be that keynote someday. And I recognize that if they can see that it's, I want to make it so that people can see it's possible to get there. Because I started out just as afraid and like everybody else. So now it's more of a, I put myself out there because it is a waste of time, me questioning whether I should be myself. That doesn't mean that sometimes I might go, oh, I want to post that. No, I'm going to post that. That's fine. I think that like pragmatism is good.
It's normal.
But also the people who know me know I'm a musician. And if you go to a conference with me, everybody's like, when are we taking Lance to karaoke? Let's go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So like, I know how people see me and I know how I'm seen and I know how I see myself. And that is the key, is like, you need to have the situational awareness, but really, it's just, I want to live a life where I am acting as the way I would love and expect and want everybody else to, which is an active form of freedom. I am not tied and bound down to the worries of the external world. I am more tied and bound down to my convictions and where I stand, but with openness and a beginner's mind, meaning if I may have a conviction or a belief, but I hopefully I can be changed if it's not a good belief, right? You know, things like that. So it's like kind of like this agile mindset, because we're always going to change, but at the same time, be yourself, be moment. So in that moment when I posted some music, it was like, I was in the moment feeling music. And I'm like, I want you to feel that with me too. And so my attempt is to be like, you don't have to do that per se, but, you know, go ahead and be yourself in a moment. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, I loved it. I second guess every time I'm about to post something on LinkedIn. I get imposter syndrome. Sometimes I'm like, why am I even making content?
I can teach you how to get rid of imposter syndrome. So imposter syndrome, you have to understand why it exists. It exists because we compare ourselves to others, right? So for instance, every time you go, oh, I'm a failure in your mind or whatever it is. Now, imposter syndrome is also slightly normal. But because we have a social network of the way we are and, you know, our beauty and all these things, imposter syndrome is getting climbing higher and higher and higher. The reality is that in imposter syndrome, if you realize it's comparing, the only thing you should ever compare, and this is easier said than done, but is yourself from the day before. Like, you should change your framework of going, when I'm in a room with very smart people, be excited. Because, like, they're going to be very, like, smart, but you're also going to have something to offer. Because what I think the problem with humanity is that we spend our childhood trying to assimilate and model to our parents, which is normal because that's how the world works. Then we get out of this, and then we have all this, like, stuff in our head. And half the time, it's the parental model that's, like, talking to us and trying to, because that's kind of just how the brain works, right? And then what will happen is that we're comparing and, like, oh, I'm not good at this and that. You can't truly metrically compare a human to another human. I'm 45, had absolutely crazy independent experiences than anybody else in this world. There are some that I can relate. For instance, if another father loses a child, we can talk and relate on certain things, but how he feels and how he acts on it is going to be absolutely different. How the person died might be different. Like, those are it's literally almost like trying to do machine learning, but the data sets are absolutely, they're independent. It's not blackjack here where the cards are dependent on each other. Every human being has this like thing. What's cool about our human beings is we can relate instead of compare it. Relating allows for us for having like a good conversation. Oh, I feel you. I can have empathy. I understand you more. Tell me more. Relating is the bridge, like almost like pulling out the drawbridge, right? Here's my really, I'm going to relate to you, right? Now we go back to imposter syndrome on the comparison. If you can relate, you can also then realize that every human beings, since they are unique and cannot be comparable, has something to offer. So you probably come from the recruiting world and in certain areas there. So accept the fact that you're probably not going to be the guy writing malware on a red team, but that doesn't right. make you an important asset to the security industry. I'll tell you right now, I've been doing recruiting all day for the last 2 weeks going, crap, we need recruiting help. And I've been learning the process using AI and like ChatGPT to ask, like, what do I do next? And like this and that. And it gave me a massive respect for the recruiting process and the people who work in recruiting. So if I said I'm not smart in recruiting, I'm not saying, oh, I'm dumb and generalizing. I'm saying, wow, that's a space that I never got a chance to learn, but that is a space that I really respect. And that's an entire, and my brain, just like we talked about blue teams, I don't have the brain for that. But the blue teamers do, the HR people, the level of organization, the charisma, the dealing with people and actually understanding that a rejection letter matters, or, you know what I mean? Like, and how it matters and that process. I'm having to use AI to learn like tidbits of a big industry. So what is there to really compare to except that you're in that industry? And if you see someone that's like more senior, then it's like almost like treated like kohai senpai, like you have a lot to learn, but it's not, you should excite it. I'm like, I can learn from this person. And even in their learning person, remember they always say that the master always learns from the student, you know, they're also going to, so it's like more of a cooperation. And once we realize it's not comparison, but cooperation in our unique value sets, imposter syndrome can go away. But it's just tell yourself when you start feeling that way, take another thought, like you can take, okay, I'm like, oh, I'm not like this good. Try to like then go stop and recognize that and go, what's an alternative real way of looking at this? If I wasn't myself and someone else was looking at that position, are they really thinking I'm a failure inside? No, we're the only one thinking that. One, because most people don't think about us as much as we think about ourselves. But two,
right.
Like if you're looking at someone, you're never like looking and going, oh man, that person's stupid. Do you ever have that thought in your mind? No, it's only in your mind that you have that. Right. So you can actually shift that thought. You know what I mean? It just takes a lot of work and I'm telling you this because I actually try, I go to therapy and I've worked on that. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. So,
yeah. People don't really care if it's something that you posted and if they're not,
going to die.
They just scroll, you know, right by
unless
it.
Unless I'm like posting a crime, no one's going to care.
Right. No one cares. Yeah. Yeah. You know? There is one hack that I heard yesterday. I can't remember the person's name, but the method is whenever you start writing something or thinking about content or writing a script or something like that, if you start with "Dear Son," and you write from the heart, like you're talking to a child, or, you know, even it could be your mother or something like that. If you write in that tone of voice and then you end it with "Love, Dad," or "Love your," you know, if you come from that place, it'll become so much easier for you to feel more comfortable about the, at least the tone of voice you're writing in. And it helped me.
Yeah. And not only that. So I want to adapt to that, because actually there's a book I'm reading right now called The Art of Communicating. It's by Thich Hat Hanh. He's a Zen master. He's passed on, but he's, you know, recently passed on. So it's very up to date because it talks about devices and all the things. Right. And he's literally talking about writing out to be more compassionate. Right. Like how to, like, if you write, it helps you with like being present and compassionate. And so every year I also write to myself. I sit down and I go, what are my wants and needs for this year? Right. You know, I just, you know, once, what do I need to get there? Blah, 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 blah. You know, goal setting is, you know, what did Albert Einstein say? You want to be happy, set goals. Right. So goal setting. Right. Then I can, you know, turn that into like a letter that is written as if it's something I read every day, right? It's on my back screen on my desktop right now. And what it is a vision letter that is written to me, but like as if I'm reading it from somebody else, but it's read as if it's already happening. Like I did this and blah, blah, blah. And I've had to have an adventure doing this and all these things. And reading it every day, I have a reminder and it also is on my back screen. So it like subconsciously reads it, right?
Oh, wow.
I learned this from a coach, right? An executive coach. The brain, kind of like vision boards, why therapists recommend vision boards, but it's the same. The brain is a hacking tool too. Right. So it's a computer, right? It's kind of like a Bayesian network. So it's like machine learning. It'll follow trends. If you create a bad habit, it'll keep going to that habit. It doesn't care about bad, good or bad. It just sees habit. No, you want to go that way? Okay, let's go that way. And it'll fight you till it becomes that habit, but it'll, you know, get there, right? That's why building a habit can take 2 to 3 weeks. But essentially, it's a habit machine, right? And the more you get into a habit of this and you read to yourself this thing, your brain starts believing it occurs, which then seems to like at least generate this. Now, I've got a crazy miracle story. When I first tried this from my coach years ago, I think it was 2020, you dated a year in advance. So as if it's already okay. A year later too. So the cool part about it is I was like, yeah, I did a TED talk, da da da, because I always wanted to do one. It was actually kind of like on my bucket list. A month later, I didn't even put it out there. Someone hit me up, a friend of mine that was supposed to do it and literally had to cancel. And he goes, I recommend Lance. And he goes, hey, do you want to do a TED talk? I'm like, what the hell is this magic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so like, now I will admit I have crazy synchronicity. It was just felt like the vision. I just kept reading off of it, and it was like, the what, right? You know, so it just kind of started coming more and more true. And I was like, at first was skeptical, and I was like, okay, I don't understand all of that, but it's almost like a feedback loop, and your brain feels more confident in it and stuff. But the cool thing is that we go back to your letter. If you write a letter to yourself too, it doesn't have to just be vision. It could be about something nice about yourself so that you don't call yourself a failure. Like right. I always have this thing where I say, change your language, right? If you talk bad about yourself or inside your mind over time, you will feel bad about yourself, right? Just like a computer, it goes with the trend. Muhammad Ali said, he goes, I used to tell myself I was the greatest before I ever believed it. And so he programmed his mind to become the greatest. And that's what I'm saying. It's like, if you get it caught up back into your imposter syndrome, you got caught into this negative thinking, catch it, switch it. Find a compassionate way of like, almost like dear, be your own dad. You know what I'm saying? You know
right,
what I'm saying?
Right.
Like dear son. Actually, I learned that also a piece of that in self-awareness workshops where you literally have to like be the father of your own inner child inside. And the more you did that, like you kind of heal the misunderstandings. Not all of it is like crazy trauma, but there are misunderstandings due to how the world works and the parent models. So yeah, so it's like a computer as well.
Yeah. I've got a lot to learn there. And I do need to write that letter to myself. That's actually a good idea. And you write it with all the things you want to happen, and you write it as if they already happened.
Yeah.
And that's
and
like
positive belief. It's a law of attraction. It's not scientific, so I can't prove it. So right. I'm just saying from my experience, it has been like it's been pretty shocking. Yeah.
Before you brought up that you're in the process of hiring, and I did want to chat with you about your experience, because I saw you had a posting up seeing your pen tester, and I was just curious. I know what it's like whenever I post a job now. How many applicants have you gotten in the last 11 days since that role was open?
289, but LinkedIn pre-filters, right? So I put like these questions. You have to have Python for 5 years. You have to have, you know, background check. We deal with pretty crazy stuff. I mean, I'm usually forgiving on background checks, but these days it's like the clients won't be. So, and I will actually check like how many actually get filtered through, right? So the challenge I have, here we go. We go to the jobs.
While you do that, I did a post on LinkedIn the other day, and I had a software engineer posting in Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. It was hybrid on-site role. In 24 hours, I had 411 applicants. And I walked through item by item that I was screening for, and I didn't even get through hardly half of them, and I was already down to zero candidates.
Oh, and wow.
I was trying to give the candidate marketplace kind of an indication of what's happening, how your resume is getting screened out. So maybe this could be another lesson for them in, you know, what you're looking for, your process, like what criteria are you using, and then how many did you wind up with?
Okay, so let me check out the view applicants. So I got, there's also how many I can actually handle at one time.
Right, exactly. Day, right? Yeah, it becomes too much.
So I've got 244 applicants and 102 results, right? So most of the results, I still have like a backlog, but time is time, right? So I only have so much time in the day. So I'll tell you my approach that I did, because I don't have, you know, a recruiting firm. So we have, you know, an AI system for enterprise. So we can share, you know, private data that like is our company data that doesn't get trained and stuff like this, right? So we have an enterprise GPD, and you can create a GPD. So I called it, you know, HR assistant. And I said, here is our mission values. And I gave it documents, mission values. And I said, here's examples of pen test reports. Here's our jobs. I gave it our service catalog, right? Like these are things you can do pre to give the AI, right?
You trained it. Yeah.
I trained it on all of these documents to reference it, right? It's kind of like a fine tuning. They wouldn't probably call it training an AI, but like it's fine tuning, right? And then I said, you are, you know, get all your research and units. You want to understand our culture. And then I also introduced myself. I introduced all the executives in our company, what our needs are, all this stuff, right? And I did a whole thing to it. And you can mod it as you need it if it needs perfecting, right? And so then I go in, it's an HR assistant. So then I'll take, you know, when we first pushed the post, I started pulling out like, all right, I got like 17, 20 resumes here. So I drop them in my, you know, folder, right, under that section. And then I'll attach one at a time separately as a different HR assistant thing. For the reason why is I'm kind of against comparisons until like the last mile. The cool thing about AI doing so, like I told it to score it like 10 out of, like basically out of 10, like each section for culture fit, skills and experience, this and that, for resume matching only. It doesn't mean that they're best or not best fit. It just means, does this resume fit, like our culture fits based on what AI might think, so that I can figure out, give me the top 10 people to schedule a meeting with, you know, all the qualities that we needed. And so it would be like, this person got an 8.5. And so it would literally, I'm like, give me top 10, give me top 20, give me 30. So I would just go and start with top 10 based on that. And then write, you know, I'd write a letter out to each one and, you know, hey, invite them to do an interview. I would then record the transcript. Like I keep the transcripts. I'm in a one party state. I'm allowed to do that. So I, you know, this call may be recorded or monitored, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but I record the interview. And then I take that say transcript and I throw that into that person's interview with their resume, with the job description. And I have a file that's called this in their AI, right? And I'm like, all right, you know, John Doe, how did he do on his, now score his interview process based on strengths? And I also ask it to give me questions that are pertinent to what we need, that are standardized across every person, but still somewhat relatable to the resume. For instance, if I'm looking for, you know, GCP and they have AWS, I, you know, what's your experience with cloud? Do you think you could learn GCP versus like, we know obviously maybe GCP is not their thing, but I don't want them going like, you know, hey, do you think you could learn it? Active continuous learning, which is part of our culture, right? So it would then like the AI would then go and give a score on like, they seem adaptive. They seem, they can continuous learn. They can do this, they can do that. And it would score each one. I do it individually so it doesn't compare yet. And then I'd throw those scores in and just get a list of the players of like, who's now on our list. And the cool part is that I also have my human side of my interviews and my process, and it matches pretty much where I'm at. I really like this person is number one. Oh my gosh, he's probably going to be harder to get because he's probably going to be like the perfect candidate. Because one of the perfect candidates, I literally was like, that guy scored like a 10 out of 10. Now he was referenced in because of the job. So that's a lot easier. Is one of the things is the reference is going to obviously, as you know, have a lot higher value because someone else can speak to their work. Right. But for honestly, this AI scoring is what I've been doing. I do think there's an entire app that you can make with this and like make it like a career path and journey. And it's not just like that. You could de-racify, which is great because I got like at least five, the first five, three of them are, you know, not white people. You know what I mean? So like, it doesn't care about the name. So like, then you don't even have to worry about like a word diversity. You just like go through skills, focus, this, that, blah, blah, blah. And it skips all the, it removes all that bias for you. Cause you can tell it, you know, remove all the bias, just focus on these things. And it will, you know, I don't care if they've got like a name I can't pronounce. They're getting interviewed because their skills match the system. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
You know what I mean? So like, that's the power of this, is that that's one of the things I think AI is going to be very good with, is de-racifying, de-biasing, like, you know, people may be convinced there's set bias, but if you give it any guardrails of instructions of like, anonymize the names, remove all of that information. I just need party 1, 2, 3, and 4, right? Like, then it will make decisions about that, right? So it's just, you know, cleaning the data, this and that. So that's the process I've been doing. And then it'll be like, all right, what's the next step? Okay, get them to the next round. And so that's how I've been doing it, because we don't have an HR person, which we'll be hiring on June. But, you know, so that's the challenge. And the reason I had to do it is we had an HR, like, not an HR, but like a recruiting company, but they disappeared on us for a bit. And we're just like, dude, we're like in the middle. And we do a lot of contract work. It's not always, you know, full-time hires, right? And so if we need like, hey, we need a Kubernetes pen tester, we need this and that, they just kind of disappeared. And we just heard from them today. Apparently they were sick, but I'm like, we need to talk about a redundancy plan, because we messaged other folks, you know, and I'm like, so hey,
I know a good cybersecurity recruiter. We'll need a plan B.
Yeah, I do. And so, you know, let's talk offline for sure. So absolutely. I saw that today and I'm like, oh yeah, man, good timing. Huh, there's the synchronicity.
Yeah, maybe. Hey, you needed it. The universe has brought it right here to you.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. So, and if like, honestly, I believe that. I don't know if everybody has their own beliefs, religions, all that stuff. But for me, that's the thing that works for me. So,
I believe it 100%. I just need to exercise it more. But man, I did not. So I've always been afraid, you know, AI is going to take all the jobs, right? AI is going to take
it. Just helps you organize.
But you're using AI to do like so much stuff that I never even thought about. And that's wild, man. So that was,
but in a good way, but it doesn't mean I don't need an HR person. I still need a call for some HR stuff, because what it taught me was there's a lot to this entire process. Yeah. And thank you, AI, for being like an intern to help me get through some of it today and next week and next week. But that is not, I can't scale. I'd have to write an AI to do that. And I don't have the time for that either. Like over time. And my job is like the rule we have at the company. If I'm doing it and it's not the CEO's job, then we need to hire for it. This was like our CTO happened to leave for 10 days on vacation. So it was kind of like, hey, this is what we're going to do, because we were going to do it as a team and stuff. But like, I'm like, let me just get it done. I've been playing with AI for almost 2 years in the sense of how to talk to it. And you can actually ask it to teach you how to talk to it. And that's the secret.
I saw a tool that just came across my LinkedIn feed, where the AI voice assistants now are going to be doing the initial screening call. Candidates are going to be talking to this AI, and you can tell it what questions to ask, and you know, you get the recording. So, you know, you get one AI actually doing the screening call, and then you load the transcript into another AI to rate how the person did. And then they're out there while you're working, right? You're busy doing CEO stuff, right? You got a couple of AIs kind of working for you, doing your recruiting. And then they're just going to be like, hey man, we've talked to 48 people. Here's our top two. Which one do you want? You know what I mean?
So I've already been thinking about this and wrote up the whole thing of this. I like your AI thing. I actually, the AI voice part kind of hit me earlier today, because I was reading, you know, how AI has a button where you can read off and they have their voices, and I was busy. So I was having it read to me, the interview questions.
Okay.
While I was preparing. And I'm like, oh shit, that sounds so human that it's kind of like, like, oh man, like you could technically do a phone interview this way. You know what I mean? So
yeah. Especially, you know, if they're Scarlett Johansson's voice.
I heard about that. Yeah. I find it a little impersonal, but I don't mind putting in the work, because we are a people oriented company here. Like I learned something the other day. I got an email or a thing, and it was a busy day. And it was from a guy on LinkedIn, and in LinkedIn, you have the automatic rejection letters, right? There's a template, right? Mm-hmm. I remember when I was looking at posting the job, I was like, it was like one liner or two liner. And I remember going, no, I'm going to fill that out and like make that warm and personal. Like I know what it's like to be rejected when your job holding, and it can be very like frustrating. So I wrote I don't even remember what the heck I wrote, but like, because I did this a couple of weeks, like what you said, 11 days ago, but in the moment,
you probably wrote like a dear son type of,
I wrote a dear son type of thing. Yeah, here it is. Thank you so much for your interest in your senior position, you know, senior pen test position at UT. We truly appreciate the time and effort you put in your application and consider joining our quest to tackle the most complex security challenges. After careful review, we have decided to move forward with other candidates whose experience align more closely with our current needs, which is how we do it, right? The guy was a data scientist. So senior, you know what I mean? But shoot your shot, please. You know what I mean? Because I might need a data scientist later, right? However, maybe. This does not diminish our appreciation for your impressive background and your potential to make a significant impact in the field of cybersecurity. We would love to keep your resume on file and potentially reach out regarding further opportunities that may be a better fit. We believe in nurturing connections and hope to find another opportunity to possibly work together. Thank you again for your interest in Unit2MB and sharing your professional journey with us. We wish you all the best in your future endeavors and hope to cross path again. Warm regards, Unit2MB team.
That's as good as it can get right there.
I did this because to me, like, this is how I would communicate to somebody.
Yeah.
And my personal life, I practice, my religion is practicing compassion, right? Like, there's like, it's a more of a practice, but you know, that's how I look at the world, is that it needs more compassion in it. So I work on that. And you know, I just, this is the culture of us and it's important to me. And I got an email, like a LinkedIn message telling me from this person, they said, I get rejection after rejection and I was getting frustrated. And then I saw yours and he goes, and I got hope again and inspired. And thank you very much. Like, da 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 da.
Yeah, good job.
And it's a canned message, but it's not, it's still the intent of, I know that there's going to be a human at the end of that and that every human should be treated in that same value, right? You know, you don't realize how, like, I just did that 11 days ago and like, this is how I did it. But then when someone sends that, I told them, I said, you made my day today. Right. Yeah. You know, it's like, you're like, that's important, right? It's a very, very, very awesome thing to say, because when you can give someone else a smile or a little bit of keep going, yeah, that's the difference. And that is me embracing the absolute unique trusting myself moment. We go back to like, what makes you do that? Because like, why would I want to live a short life? Because like, when my son died, you kind of get this representation of realizing life can be very precious, very short. So I don't get a choice of when I live or die, right? So if I'm going to live, like, that confidence, that this, that compassion, that this, I want to live the man I wanted to be in the first place. So I'm going to practice doing that at home and, you know, come out with it in my ways of living. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Respect. Yeah. I love it, man. It's gotta be tough. I got two boys. They're twins. They're 4 and my daughter's 6. So, yeah.
My daughter just turned 21. So,
oh really? You ain't old enough to have a 21 year old.
My son will be 22. So maybe 23 actually. I got to double check. So yeah.
I hear you. Yeah, you've already been through it and got the t-shirt and,
t-shirt. The whole nine.
Hey, it's been fun. Great to meet you and hope we can talk again. And yeah, let's talk offline.
Heck yeah, let's do it. Yeah, I definitely want to talk to you about recruiting. So
yeah. Now I'm excited.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. See you, buddy. All right. Thanks.
Bye.